nominees.
For 1 week, 13 parliament commissions will be working 3 shifts a day, where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the 1 week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in parliament, where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ibrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing, and so we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland a permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into 3 areas. Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone, or it locates close to settlements and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as the Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdus Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthis aimed to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be opened for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdus Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the presence of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem because, as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital Kabul and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul. That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. The advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city, where its governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine, which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyatullah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
While Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus, it stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Neura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region, and this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place. Experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they're described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang. The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After 5 years of the closure imposed on Sana'a International Airport by Saudi Arabia, Yemen has held a protest inside the airport to renew their demands and call for its reopening. Protesters chanted slogans urging the international community to push Riyadh to remove its merciless blockade on Yemen.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has caused a major humanitarian crisis and it is a war crime. Yemenis are not trapped and considered hostages. The Ministry of Health statistics confirmed that more than 95,000 patients have died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and 480,000 patients urgently need to travel and their fate is unknown amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. There are also 4 million expatriates who want to return, but the airport closure prevented them.
The repercussions of the Saudi violation of international covenant on civil and political rights and closing Sana'a International Airport are getting worse, especially to those with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and liver, who hope to travel abroad for proper medical treatment, but unfortunately it seems impossible, at least for a while.
5 years since the closure of Sana'a Airport, which is not a short period, it has caused an exacerbation of human suffering because the airport is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis. Before the war, 6,000 passengers, including 100 patients, used to leave every day from Sana'a Airport. More than 30 patients die every day due to the restrictions on the airport. There are more than 70,000 cancer patients and 20,000 kidney failure patients who need to travel for treatment amid the collapse of the healthcare system due to the fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detention of Yemeni oil ships.
At the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen besides its rule, resulting in the closure of Sana'a International Airport to all flights and trapping millions of Yemenis, including patients, in a war zone. However, Sana'a Airport still receives the United Nations flights alone on a daily basis.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this airport. People here say the Saudi blockade goes against international law and its requirement that everyone should be free to leave any country, including their own. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A lawsuit brought against the Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the Prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on three occasions. In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice. But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. Add to that the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him.
66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Purza, London.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints you are listening to. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, since this is the month of Muharram and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. We know that from 41, we can say AH, till 132 AH, for 91 years, the Umayyad established a government on the Muslim lands, starting from Levant and getting all across the borders of the Muslim lands out of Arab Peninsula and Hejaz, today Saudi Arabia. But all of a sudden, many values have been changed, and many pure Islamic values have been violated. We know that the most horrendous, we can say, massacres happened during this period. We could see that what happened to the family and the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We could remember what they have done to, in the Harra event, the massacre of the people and the killing of the people over there. Also, Mukhtar al-Saghafi uprised against them, but he was killed again. And you know that in these 91 years, we can say Islam was deviated from the right path. This was what Umayyads did, Umayyads and their kings and the rulers did to the Muslim Ummah on that time. Dr. Fakhrani, let's start with you. Give us a historical background, how the Umayyads got power and how they established a government in the Muslim lands.
Yes.
Because they are not at all like a pure Muslim, according to what Prophet Muhammad claimed, that this one is a Muslim, this one is an Islamic ruler, or he gave the standards and the criteria. How did they establish a government in Arab Muslim lands on that time?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this regard, I mean, regarding the background of the Umayyad dynasty, it must be indicated that, first of all, we have to go back, I mean, we have to trace the background to the pre-Islamic period in Arabia.
That's right.
Okay? As we know, the city of Mecca, because of the Kaaba over there, has been especially favored by not only Arabs, but all those people who favored monotheism.
That's right.
Okay?
That's right.
And in Arabia, there were some Arab clans and Arab tribes. Okay? The Quraysh, who was the main, I mean, who made the main, I mean, populace of the region, was divided into two main clans, Hashimites, or the sons of Hashem, and Umayyads, okay?
Or the sons of Umayyah.
Umayyah, yes.
That's right. Umayyah was the grand-grandfather or the forefather,
yes,
the
ancestor.
The ancestor, that's right.
And at that time, for some time, the Umayyads were in charge of custody of the Kaaba.
Right.
And they pretended to favor the pilgrims who used to come from almost all parts of the Arab world of the day to Mecca on pilgrimage.
That's right.
Historical records indicate that while the Umayyads were in charge of, the Kaaba, and the main sanctuary of Mecca, in the guise of helping the pilgrims, they looted their properties, and they did unjust to pilgrims. Okay, for some time, they showed that in order to perform pilgrimage around the Kaaba, to do the circumambulation,
yes,
around the Kaaba,
okay,
it was necessary to buy the Hajj garment, ihram, from the Umayyads and not from anybody else. And in case that there wasn't anything, people were, were right to be naked and, to
That's
do
right.
the, rituals, in a naked mode.
And we know that the tribe of Umayyah on that time, and also Harb, the son of Umayyah, the father of Abu Sufyan, were famous for their business transactions all out of the Arab Peninsula on that time. They were famous rich tribes on that time. They did so before Islam in the Jahiliyyah period. True aristocrats, I can call them, and the monarch of the time, whose we can't say the money was important for them. So it is absolutely natural that they look at religious rituals at something to get money from. To make money out of it.
They were notorious for being too mercenary.
Uh-huh.
However, and there was a council. A council was made. In Mecca, and the Meccan important people of Mecca came to the conclusion that the supremacy of the Umayyads, the descendants of Umayyah in Mecca, as custodians of the Kaaba, brought all havocs and misfortune to the Kaaba, and deterred the people from doing pilgrimage to the Kaaba.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Okay.
Let me contribute just one point. Okay?
Because I have to manage the time, get to,
yes,
Brother Ali too. Okay?
In order to compensate it, okay, in order to make the reform, people came to the point that the other, main clan, Bani Hashim, the Hashimites,
that's right,
were the most appropriate people. Since the time the Hashimites,
that's right,
got to power, we find that the Umayyads started developing all sorts of conspiracies against the Hashemites.
That's
over
right.
There. Yes.
And when I look at the genealogy and the family tree of Umayyad, he had three important sons. They were named As, Harb, and Abi Amr. And, you know, Abu Sufyan, Muawiyah, and Yazid, we are mainly concerned with them. And the atrocities that they have done toward the, we can say, Muslim Ummah comes from the family tree of Harb. It is also documented that there were some disputes among the Harb and Abdul Muttalib, the grandfather or the forefather of Prophet Muhammad. It's been documented in the history. Brother Ali Al-Abiyan, let's get to you. Whenever we say Bani Umayyah and Umayyads in the Islamic calendar, the first thing that is reminded in the minds of the people is the atrocities that they have done to Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes,
but I think we have to trace back their roots, as Dr. Fakhruhani also said, to the pre-Islamic period, the type of typical behaviors that they had, and the type of typical behavior from the Jahiliyyah period that they remained in themselves. They converted into Islam, but I think according to a very superficial mannerism. What's your take on that, brother?
Yeah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. As for the pre-Islam era that actually want to look at the role of Umayyads and Umayyads, Dr. Fakhr actually elaborated on it. Let's see what happened at the time of the, if we can call it government, if as I myself do not believe in it, to say that, for example, the government which was at the hand of Hashemites, meaning the Holy Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam. So
right.
It's not good to call it in such a sense, but just to make it closer to understanding for the respected listeners.
You mean establishing a state?
Yeah, establishing since the Holy Prophet was the leader of the Islamic Ummah, actually. We believe in Ummah and the leader of the Ummah. So we saw that actually they were silent at this time, and as it was said, at the time of Hashemites, they were silent. Umayyads, or the ancestors of the Umayyads, or Umayyads, were silent, and actually they were involved in their business and this kind of, let's say, the transactions that they had at that time, involved in their own trade and business.
That's right.
But it did not mean, it does not mean that actually they do or they did agree with what was going on. They disagreed with the system that the Holy Prophet actually introduced to the world. But since they were out of the power, so they showed their disagreement through some, let's say, hypocrisies. But anyhow.
That's right. You're absolutely right. But even Abu Sufyan, when Prophet was after, we can say, conquering Mecca, Fath al-Mecca, you know, he was forced, and in fact, into convert to Islam, and it was not with open arms.
That's why actually they were called as tulaqa. I mean, they did not accept Islam. Easily, they were forced to accept it. Actually,
that's right.
They found no way around. But how they again found their way inside the government and inside the system? It was from the time of Second Caliph, when he appointed Yazid, father of Muawiyah, as the governor of Damascus.
That's right.
Or Sham of the time.
Osman, you mean?
No, second caliph.
But Omar did it, but I think Osman himself was from the Umayyad side.
Yeah.
From the father side, okay?
Very true.
And he gave them very much power, empowered them in different lands of
but, the influence of Umayyad actually started from the side of Sham, where...
Yes.
Actually, this election of Yazid, father of Muawiyah, was done at the time of Second Caliph, when he actually died due to a sickness or disease. He by himself selected Muawiyah as his successor. So we see that Muawiyah actually changed the system that was introduced by the Holy Prophet to the world. Actually, he de-Islamized, if I can use this.
Sorry, before getting to the character of Muawiyah, which was really influential in changing the system, I do want to say, such a powerful man at the Levant on that time, I mean the Eastern Syria in today's world, must have found the chances and the background to empower himself with such opportunities. What was the main background that made Muawiyah actually, find such a power?
After the Holy Prophet, at the time of the first caliph, the relationship of this Umayyad family was not that bad with the caliph. They had only a very soft criticism on the selection of Abu Bakr as the first caliph.
That's right.
Why? Because Abu Bakr was not directly connected to the sons of Umayyad, and he was from a second-hand, let's say, tribe. He was belonging to a tribe actually connected to Quraysh, and they were actually...
And Umayyads were from the Quraysh tribe too?
True.
Okay, that's right.
So this was their soft criticism, but anyhow, they preferred to cooperate with the new government or new system that actually was taking the hand of leadership of the Islamic Ummah. And mostly at the time of the second caliph, when he started conquering Islam and conquering other countries and expanding the Islam territories, they were selected as the leaders of the and the commanders of the armies to conquer some countries, namely Iran and neighboring countries. So they started working with the government informally and to some extent formally and officially.
That's right.
So this was the first, actually, glimpse of their entrance towards the system.
That's right.
Through this, actually, activities, the second caliph reached to this conclusion, no, they can be good people, so we can accept them. They had good relation, beside the curtain. And he started to actually elect Yazid as the governor of Damascus, as
you
I
mean
said.
Yazid, the father of Muawiyah.
They
say that there was a council.
And since Muawiyah loved his father too much, he named his son again Yazid.
That's right. After that, Yazid also called him as Muawiyah.
Yeah.
Of course, the second Muawiyah was, they say, according to some documents, very much different and regretted the behaviors of his forefathers. Mm. But they say also, Dr. Fakhrani, thank you very much, Brother Ali. A six-member council on that time, Abdul Rahman ibn Auf was one of them, and he had direct role in choosing the caliph at the time of Osman. He was in, we can say, direct connections with the Umayyads, and so the Umayyads' role in selecting the caliph also is into the scene. I mean, the conspiracies and the plots, the political plots that are done behind the scene is also clear. Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alivian and Dr. Mamarza Fakhruhani. Nice tracing back of the Islamic roots, how Umayyads got the power and how we're deviated from the right path. We will talk more about the Muawiyads and Muawiyah himself in establishing a dynasty, I mean, over there as called the Bani Umayyah, and the peace treaty that he signed with Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba. What were the reasons and why Muawiyah selected Yazid, his notorious son, as the next successor to the Umayyad dynasty? It was very kind of you. I really appreciate what you do for the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This is Viewpoints on iRib English Radio. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam Radio. Also send us your emails and comments on our YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Khalaf Islam Radio. We again express our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. Till another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaykum, ya Abu Abdullah.
Look here, Zahra.
Look here, Zahra.
Look here, Zahra.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. One of the main features of Imam Hussein's uprising was insight. Insight means observing the present events, realizing their outcome, and making the best decision accordingly. The Noble Quran compares those who have insight with those lacking it and says, "Is he who was lifeless? Then we gave him life and provided him with a light by which he walks among the people, like the one who dwells in a manifold darkness which he cannot leave. Such has been decorated for the faithless what they have been doing." The climax of insight can be seen in Imam Hussein's movement. He recognized the conditions of society and exposed his life and his family to the hardest calamities to save mankind. Mankind is always subjected to sedition and diabolic schemes of those who intend to achieve their goals at the cost of others' life and properties. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein staged his great uprising to revive the religion of his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He said, "Don't you see that truth is not practiced and falsehood is not prevented?" The Imam showed to Muslims throughout history that they should sacrifice whatever they have to revive Islam and to protect it against corruption and deviation. He reminded all that when the ruling system and scholars become corrupt, so that the Noble Quran is distorted and good is demonstrated as evil and vice versa, it is obligation to return the society to the right path. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, would supplicate, "My God, make my movement on the basis of wakefulness, my way on the basis of guidance, and cause my course to abide by growth and sublimity." The Imam would call on the people to move with insight, as insight would preserve them of misguidance and deception. Late Professor Sayyid Jafar Shahidi said, "The Ashura uprising was apparently fruitless on that day, yet it had not just one fruit, but many fruits. It seems that this uprising was quenched by Yazid's calamities, but it never subsided. The Imam's message was revived once by the uprising of Suleiman Surat and once by the rule of Mukhtar, who had staged an uprising for avenging the blood of the Master of Martyrs. Later on, it inspired all those who are suffering from the injustice of rulers." In Karbala, the encampment of Imam Hussein was the place of religious and insightful people from all walks of life who understood their historical duty properly. They knew well that they wanted and in what path they were marching. They knew that if the Umayyad regime is the ruler of the Islamic realm, Islam would perish forever. Had they not acted, humanity would have been destroyed forever. Among the personalities of Karbala, the valiant brother of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon him, shines like a moon. He was outstanding in bravery, horsemanship, combat, worship, and cognizance of God. He was so steadfast that Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, I testify that you did not show weakness for a single moment and did not return from your path. Rather, your path had been based on faith and insight. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, drew a beautiful picture by his uprising. He showed mankind that whenever oppression and injustice have permeated everywhere and the light of good virtues has subsided, we should stand up and move to revive divine values even at the cost of our lives. That's why the epic of Karbala did not end with the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his 72 loyal companions. It has rather transcended man's history and shines like a beacon for the seekers of freedom and all divine values.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. When we go through all the verses of the Quran, you know, on different occasions, like a lot of us go on a marathon of reading the Quran during the holy month of Ramadan, which I think is absolutely wonderful, to at least, at bare minimum, once a year, have that solid, consistent connection with the Quran and read it every day. And inevitably, when you read something so often, you will, you know, eventually have it on your mind more often when you're exposed to it more, right? So during these times, when we have that consistent connection with the Quran and are more exposed to it, we will notice a pattern in the Quran, right? Something that I've noticed the Quran constantly emphasizes upon is caring for one another, not just as Muslims, but as humanity, as a species, right? Let's listen to this short story and perhaps we'll get a better idea of what exactly it is I'm trying to get through, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, Salamun Alaikum, dear friend. Welcome to this episode of Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of each episode. The title of today's story is Help Others to Help Yourself. Once upon a time, there lived a farmer who grew high-quality award-winning corn. Each year, he would enter in the state farmers' fair and win a gold award for his exceptionally good corns. The farmer's high-quality corn was praised all around in the state. The success story of his exceptional corn reached the ear of a journalist, and he wanted to interview the farmer. While he was learning about the agriculture process of the farmer, he discovered that the farmer shared his best quality seeds with his neighbors. How can you afford to share your best corn seeds with your neighbors when some of them compete with you in the agriculture fair? Asked the curious reporter. Why wouldn't I, sir? Asked the farmer. Didn't you know that the wind picks up pollen from the ripening corn and swirls it from field to field? If my neighbors grew inferior quality corn, cross-pollination would eventually degrade the quality of my corn too. If I'm to grow high-quality corn, I must help my neighbors grow a good corn too. The farmer's answer made the reporter realize how aware the old farmer was about connections and life. It is the same with our life. Those who choose to live in peace must help others around them to live in peace too. The one who wishes to be loved must first learn to love others too. The one who chooses to live well must help to make others live well too. As the value of a life is measured by the lives it touches, those who choose to be happy must let others find their happiness, as the welfare of each is intertwined with the welfare of all.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
There's this famous hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, where his eminence says, a person, a Muslim, who wakes up in the morning and does not care about the affairs of other of his fellow Muslim brothers and sisters is not a Muslim. I can't be like, oh, well, I'm just going to live my life as a Muslim, trying to maintain my iman, trying to do all the worships, acts of worship and ibadah I have to do, mind my own business, stay in my own lane, living my best life. Whatever other people want to do with their world or their hereafter is none of my business. No, their life, their choice. That's not the Islamic attitude. In the Quran, in Surah Yasin, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala quotes the disbelievers as saying, why should I give charity to the poor? Because if Allah wanted them to not be poor, he would just give money to them. Right? Allah wants you to give charity. Allah wants you to take this hard-earned money and give it to a total stranger in need. Because number one, that stranger is in need. Their sustenance, Allah had put it in your possession. And secondly, he wants you to grow through this process. We're not made for this world. This world is made for us. It's made for us in the sense that we need to utilize it in every form and way to serve our growth. Caring for other people and being thoughtful toward them, considerate toward them, caring about their affairs, and caring whether they're doing well or not only helps in building a proper society that can grow and flourish in the path of Allah, but it helps me grow as an individual. And that is one of the reasons you see this pattern in the Quran of Allah constantly talking about zakat. So many verses you can find in the Quran where Allah says, الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةُ وَيَتُونَ الزَّكَاةُ. They believe. What does that mean? They pray as a pillar of religion, and they give charity. And charity doesn't necessarily always have to mean, oh, like my date crops, divide a part of that and give it to people, or my grape, or my wheat and barley. Charity is a smile. Charity is checking up on someone. Charity is sometimes financial support, emotional support, sometimes giving a good piece of advice that someone needed to hear that moment, just spreading positive energy. Because no matter how positive I think I am, if I live in a sickly community, it's bound to affect me sooner or later. And that's why Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam says that a Muslim is one who cares about his brothers and sisters, because it serves so many purposes, among which is my growth and the growth of the community as a whole. Or that there's a hadith where basically Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam entered a mosque, and there were two groups of people sitting. One was doing mubahatha, they were having a scientific academic discourse about religious things, probably fiqh or something, and akhlaq, and another group were busy doing ibadah. And Rasulullah said, they're both really good, but I'd rather sit with those fuqaha, the scholars and the thinkers, because their work is more valuable. Why is it more valuable? An abid, a worshipper, basically only benefits themselves. When I pray day and night and fast day and night and stuff like that, I'm helping myself grow spiritually, right? But unless I have the knowledge, I won't be helping others. The knowledgeable person, the proper knowledgeable person, they grow through their knowledge, they put it into action, and they spread that knowledge to the people around us. They bring benefit to the people around us. There's a hadith that says, Allah hates useless people. By useful, I don't necessarily mean you gotta go and discover the cure for cancer. If you do that, more power to you, congratulations, alhamdulillah. But being useful doesn't always mean, you know, doing something extraordinarily huge. Just making life easier for someone else. That's why we have a hadith that says Allah has never been worshipped through any means greater than bringing joy to the heart of others. Or that one who caters to the needs of his brothers and sisters, Muslim brothers and sisters, or brothers and sisters in faith in this world, and fulfills their needs, Allah will fulfill his needs on the Day of Judgment. And that's what we are most in need of, right? To be in the safe on Yawm al-Qiyamah. I'm sure you guys can think of many other points regarding what we can do to make someone else's life easier, to care for others for the sake of caring for them and our own growth. And I would like to invite you to give that a thought today. Now spend a few minutes thinking about it and seeing what we can do to, at the end of the day, make our world and the world a better place to live. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.